Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Eric Loomis about general strikes and labor in the age of Trump. Then we'll be joined by Cass Muda, a political scientist at the University of Georgia, to talk about the fine line between liberal democracy and soft authoritarianism. It's an important topic of conversation these days. Finally, we'll talk to Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept about two vicious new executive orders on immigration that have largely flown under the radar. First, a few items you may have missed. Folks, Donald Trump was reportedly as surprised as anyone else that he won the election, and he may be as dismayed as anyone else that he's president. Turns out that presidenting is a lot harder than, say, inheriting your dad's wealth or starring in a reality TV show. Politico reports, and I quote, "In interviews, nearly two dozen people who've spent time with Trump in the 3 weeks since his inauguration said that his mood has careened between surprise and anger as he's faced the predictable realities of governing, from congressional delays over his cabinet nominations and legal fights holding up his aggressive initiatives to staff infighting and leaks." The report goes on, "Trump often asks simple questions about policies, proposals, and personnel, and when discussions get bogged down in details, the president has been known to quickly change the subject." This is kind of scary. Your president is a man baby who can't deal with a lot of complexity. Trump has privately expressed disbelief over the ability of judges, bureaucrats, and lawmakers to delay or even stop him from filling positions and implementing policies. So this guy has never been told no his entire life, right? He's always gotten whatever he wanted, and that's not the way it works. So it has not been a great start for Cheeto Benito, although, of course, I'm sure his aides are telling him that all is well, that everything's going great. Remember when Trump was a tough guy who wouldn't take any flack from no foreigners, and he was all about America first, and unlike our dumb leaders, he'd tell the rest of the world to jump and they'd ask how high. Remember that? Well, it turns out that when you have no idea what you're doing, it's pretty easy to get played. According to CBS, and this is kind of delicious, Trump was ready to deliver an address about building a wall when he signed that executive order, and he was all set to say that Mexico would pay for it.
Mexico's going to pay for the wall. Mexico is making a fortune off the United States. Mexico is going to pay for the wall, and they're going to be happy about it.
But Mexican Foreign Minister Luis Videgaray, dropped by the White House that day, and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and consigliere, showed him the speech, and according to CBS, and I quote, "Videgaray was horrified," according to the Mexican officials, "and deemed the speech a non-starter. If the remarks were not changed, they would likely drive the two countries, whose relationship Videgaray was there to try and redress, even further apart. The two changed what they could, casting a more positive light on the future of the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Then the two of them went into the Oval Office so Kushner could brief Mr. Trump on the changes. The president angrily threw up his hands, wondering why he should read the new version. In the end, the speech Mr. Trump gave was far more measured than the original draft. Mr. Trump did not reiterate his now infamous line that Mexico will pay for the wall." Now, it should go without saying that the White House denied the report, calling it fake news, like they deny, everything. They deny that the sun rises in the east. So Mexico walked all over him. It's sad. By the way, Reuters reports that an internal DHS report estimates that Trump's wall would cost $21 billion and take 3 years to build. Two points here. First, when George Bush built a section of wall, it was 700 miles, it turned out to be a total boondoggle. It was a honeypot for defense contractors. It went over budget. It went over schedule. It had all of these high-tech gizmos on the border that didn't work. Various detection systems. It was just a disastrous failure. And the other salient point is that net migration from Mexico is now zero and has been for a couple of years. So, I mean, and a lot of the folks coming over the border are not Mexicans, but asylum seekers fleeing Central America. And what they do is they find a Border Patrol agent and turn themselves over. Again, they're seeking to go through the system. They're applying for asylum. And then, of course, around half of the undocumented population, depending on the study, 40% or so of the undocumented population entered through a port with a visa, with a valid visa, and then overstayed their visas. So this is pointless and costly and also a nightmare for the environment in the border region. Just a plain stupid policy. Okay, so do you remember after the election, one of the first really ham-fisted things Trump did was he picked up the phone and just kind of undid decades of U.S.-China relations by calling the Prime Minister of Taiwan, which China considers a breakaway province. And at the time, there were some folks on the right who were cheering him on. They were like, yeah, it's about time someone showed China who's boss. Well, that was then. This is now. The New York Times report, and I quote, President Trump told President Xi Jinping of China on Thursday evening that the United States would honor the One China policy, reversing his earlier expressions of doubt about the long-time diplomatic understanding. The concession was clearly designed to put an end to an extended chill in the relationship between China and the United States. Apparently, Xi Jinping had not spoken to Mr. Trump since November 14th, a week after he was elected. Administration officials concluded that Mr. Xi would take a call only if Mr. Trump publicly committed to upholding the 44-year-old policy under which the United States recognized a single Chinese government. So President Tough Guy folded like a cheap suit, probably a cheap Trump-branded suit made in China. Thanks, I'll be here all week. On Thursday, the Ninth Circuit Court refused to reinstate Trump's so-called Muslim ban. Everyone laughed when Trump tweeted in all caps, like a, I don't know, like a Breitbart commenter, in all caps, I'll see you in court. And the judges must have been like, yeah, we're judges. We're here in court every day. That's what we do. Anyway, it was widely expected that Trump would appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court. But on Friday, it was reported that the regime's lawyers were actually rewriting the executive order to try to get it to pass legal muster instead of appealing the temporary restraining order. It's unclear that, by the way, that it's possible to rewrite this order in a way that passes legal muster. But in any event, another example of Trump caving. Or so it seemed, because later on Friday there were confusing reports, perhaps suggesting that he might still take the temporary restraining order of the Supreme Court. And here's the thing. If he goes to SCOTUS, he's almost certain to lose again. And I'm sure his advisors are telling him that. And if he reverses his position and takes it to the Supreme Court, I think it will be because people on Twitter were calling him a wuss. Meanwhile, the White House is leaking like a sieve. The Huffington Post reported on some embarrassing leaks this week. S.V. Dayton, Christina Wilkie write, and I quote, for Americans who base their impression of Trump on the competent and decisive tycoon he portrayed in on his Apprentice TV shows, the portrait from these and many other tidbits emerging from his administration may seem a shock. An impulsive, sometimes petty, chief executive, and I think really always petty, chief executive, more concerned with the adulation of the nation than the details of his own policies, and quick to assign blame when things do not go his way. The report continues, unsurprisingly, Trump's volatile behavior has created an environment ripe for leaks from his executive agencies and even within his White House. And while leaks typically involve staffers sabotaging each other to improve their own standing or trying to scuttle policy ideas they find genuinely problematic, Trump's two-week-old administration has a third category. Leaks from White House and agency officials alarmed by the president's conduct. So there you have it. I have to say that we may be lucky that this regime isn't even minimally competent. Because not only are all these stumbles taking up time that might otherwise be spent ruining the country, not only are they dragging his approval ratings way down, But at some point, congressional Republicans are going to start wondering whether they need to distance themselves from this goofy regime. And on that note, let's move on with the show. Musical theme this week is Nevertheless, She Persisted. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be right back with Eric Loomis.
Every time I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low, you know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring crap to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block, I had my cutoff shorts on right, cause it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching a rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes. Said,
who you calling a bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Eric Loomis. Eric is a labor historian. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Rhode Island and the author of several books, most recently Empire of Timber, Labor Unions in the Pacific Northwest Forests. He also blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Eric, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. So this week there's been some talk of a general strike. There was a piece in The Guardian proposing such a move. It went viral. Lots of people have been talking about this. Various dates have been tossed around. And everybody I know who has a sense of what a general strike requires and the history of general strikes is saying it's a bad idea. And I should note that includes people who are very enthusiastic about the broader resistance movement against Trump. So these aren't like reflexive hippie punchers, you know? Your view?
Yeah, I basically agree. I think that, I think that we're in a point where we are talking about a wide variety of new tactics. And I think some of those are quite confrontational and engage in a kind of mass action we haven't seen in a long time. But I think that the idea of a general strike, at least in terms of how it is usually meant, is a pretty out of the question. And it, I think, assumes that everyday working class Americans are ready for such an action to actually leave their jobs and shut down entire cities. And I don't see any real evidence that that's true. And I think that it is irresponsible to call for such an action without working everyday working people, without their unions or without some sort of organization saying that, yes, this is something that we are very interested in doing.
Yeah, that's about where I am. And I would point out to listeners, you know, I remember a few years back, they had a massive protest in Oakland. It was very large, and they shut down the Port of Oakland. It should have been seen as an unqualified success, but they billed it as a general strike. And while there was a massive protest that did shut down the port, most people went to work. The world did not shut down. Oakland did not shut down. And because of this, it was widely seen as an abject failure. So super successful protest, big failure as a general strike. This is my concern. What about the action that's being organized by the people behind the Women's March? They're calling for a day without a woman, and they're calling it a general strike. But is that more likely to at least register? I mean, if 5 million women were to stay home from work and presumably hit the streets, that seems like it would be something, or maybe not. And the reason that I ask about this is that nobody expected them to turn out 5 million people, and they did.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, I think that if everybody would just quit talking about the quote general strike and start describing the actions that they're talking about in terms of what they really are.
Just don't call it that. Because
then,
you're setting yourself up for failure. I'm with you.
You are. Yeah. You are setting yourself up for failure. So if 5 million, you know, if there is a day without a woman, just as there was the, you know, day without an immigrant back in, what was that, 2007, I think, that got a lot of attention. Sure, that could be an absolutely excellent event. And I think there's all kinds of mass actions that can take place. But if your stated goal is effectively shut down the economy, you're probably not going to succeed at that, and therefore you're setting yourself up for failure.
And I should also say that, you know, if there is a Trump move that is so far, that is so outrageous, that is so clearly a challenge to our pluralistic liberal democracy, that would be a time when perhaps we would go, you know, if you think about a general strike as a nuclear strike, that, you know, maybe we want to save something in our quiver for a moment when people's attention would be focused on something specific, some specific outrage that's really like beyond what we've seen so far. You know, so far we have seen brutal executive orders and a lot of erratic behavior, but they haven't passed legislation in Congress that, you know, fundamentally threatens the Republic. And I think that we should have, you know, again, some way to turn it up to 11, and maybe a general strike is that. And that would be something that we would have to get unions involved in. And speaking of which, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. You had a great piece at the New Republic, which, of course, makes you a neoliberal sellout, but we'll overlook that for the moment. It's titled The Unions, and we know that, right? The Unions Betraying
of course,
the Left. Yes. The Unions Betraying the Left. That's the title. Rich Yesselson wrote about the same topic at Politico this week, and his piece asked whether Trump can build a permanent wedge between a good chunk of organized labor and the Democratic Party. I guess I'll start by asking you to get listeners up to speed. This is a story about the building unions specifically and their apparent, I don't know if embrace of Trumpism is overstating it, but what's going on here?
Yeah, so basically, you know, Donald Trump called in or agreed to a meeting with the building trades, which are the various unions, many of them very small in total numbers, who get a lot of construction contracts from the federal government to build any number of projects that may well include the Keystone Pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the border wall, other projects that Trump is wanting to restart. And they came in and had a meeting with him in the White House that was really quite celebratory, talking about how, you know, finally there was somebody in the White House who heard their concerns. Finally, there was somebody who would put their members to work building the kind of infrastructure that they think that we need. Meanwhile, ignoring the fact that Trump threatens the sheer existence of their non-white members, their ability of their Latino and Muslim members to even live in this country, the ability and the need to make alliances with other parts of the left over issues that are also of great concern to the building trades, and was just part of a longer series of very short-sighted actions by members of these particular unions, not the union movement as a whole, but these very specific unions that I think are really damaging and hurt the entire reputation of the labor movement among the broader resistance to Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's a very good way of summing it up. And I would just add that this is not new. When we've been talking about debates over things like the Keystone Pipeline, they have been consistently anti-environmentalist over the last, well, since that fight began. And the other point that I would make is that Donald Trump's supposed infrastructure plan, it is not what a lot of people think. It's not necessarily public spending. It would be tax breaks for private industry, for private investors to create privatized infrastructure. So it's not like a big public spending plan. According to what we know so far, there has not been a concrete proposal put on the table. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Eric Loomis. Eric, I'm very pro-union. Like, I think that no single thing could address our inequality problem more effectively than making it easier for working people to organize. But as progressives, I think it's important to differentiate between unions representing different sectors. For example, I'm all for public employees unions, but I think police unions are uniformly awful, and I think that they should be stripped of their right to bargain for anything other than, you know, pay, working condition. They shouldn't have anything to do with protecting bad cops, right? So I'd strip them of the right to collectively bargain on officer discipline specifically. So here, too, we have very different approaches from the building unions than most of the broader labor movement. You made a point to emphasize that. Let me ask you to put on your historian's hat and give us a sense of the background here, because in your piece, you make the case that the building unions have a long history of kind of reactionary politics.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the building unions really come out of the so-called skilled trades of the 19th century, where you had kind of an older style of somewhat elite white male Anglo-Saxon workers who largely controlled their own work and had avoided these kind of big industrial factory jobs at very low wages, et cetera. And from the very beginning, and here again, we're talking about the 19th century, these unions largely existed to protect the interests of a relatively small number of workers. And therefore, those unions had no interest and were even actively hostile to, say, organizing the big factories that would begin to happen in the 1930s with the CIO and the United Auto Workers and United Steel Workers, et cetera. And in fact, those interested in that kind of organizing had to leave the American Federation of Labor to make that happen. And so from the very beginning of the union movement, you have these really kind of small numbers of white males looking to protect their own interests. And this really repeats itself in many ways in the 1960s and 1970s, when you had these very unions, were the most resistant to desegregating their workplaces. These were some of the unions, or really the only unions, that say went and most notoriously in New York City beat up anti-war protesters.
Right.
Whereas you know, much of the labor movement was anti-Vietnam, these particular unions were engaging in some pretty awful behavior. And today, in this anti-environmentalist phase that some of them are in, and so unfortunately. Even though many of their actual workers are black or Muslim or Latino or in fact themselves environmentalists, the leadership of these unions has continued to really play footsie with reactionary politics. And I think that's really tragic.
And while the big industrial unions have seen their membership decline because these people build things here at home, their jobs can't be outsourced. So their representation within the larger union movement has grown. Is that right?
Well, it's more than, yes. I mean, to some extent, I mean, their numbers have dropped too. And a lot of their, because private contractors aren't really, you know, private contractors are really trying to avoid union labor and have been for a long time. And so what a lot of these building trade unions rely on are government contracts, road building and building university buildings and this sort of thing, building pipelines. Because they remain reasonably stable with the big industrial unions in total collapse, they are really once again able to play a pretty outsized role, at least for right now, in the politics of the AFL-CIO. And so, you know, even though you have these huge public sector unions that under attack themselves are representing much more progressive policies, the AFL-CIO itself doesn't really have the ability to, say, stand up strong and condemn Donald Trump on the border wall or on the Muslim ban, or really come out with a full-throated support of environmentalism, because many of their constituent members are very uncomfortable with that. And so to get back to this issue of whether Donald Trump can really put a permanent divide in the labor movement, I think it depends on what kind of workers you're talking about. If you're talking about the white building trades workers, then yes. And certainly we saw, you know, Hillary Clinton had a lower percentage of union households vote for her than any presidential candidate since 1984 in the disastrous Mondale campaign.
Any Democrat.
So this is, yes, that's right. Any Democratic presidential candidate. So this is definitely a disaster. And it's entirely possible that that does become something more permanent. However, I think that a lot of these people are also still susceptible to an economic populism from the left. And I think there's definitely room to bring them back in. And there's definitely room to increase the voting rates of the Black and Latino members that make up, you know, a really huge and growing part of the labor movement, too. So I'm skeptical on a long-term division here. But the Democrats have to be able to address some of these concerns about working class Americans that they really struggle to do.
Yes, they do. I would add that they seem to be believing a lot of Trump's rhetoric. I mean, the vast majority of jobs that these pipelines produce will be temporary jobs. I think the Keystone XL pipeline will permanently employ like 35 people. They also applauded Trump's what was basically political theater with that stupid carrier deal. So I wonder if there isn't a reckoning with reality ahead for members of these unions when they see that Trump is, as you say, not their friend.
I think there's going to be and that is going to be very likely the overturning of the Davis-Bacon Act, which is a relatively obscure law to most of your listeners, I assume, but it's a 1931, I think, law that basically forces federal contractors to pay a locally prevailing wage in government construction work. And this is what's really keeping a lot of these building trade unions up and functional. And it is opposed by large sections of the Republican Party. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has already introduced a bill to repeal that under the guise of, you know, we could have cheaper construction costs and save taxpayer money.
Right.
And the building trade unions, when they went to Trump, they said, you know, this is what we want. We want you to veto such a bill. And, you know, he basically blew them off. He sort of, in his way, seems to have said, oh, you know, sure, whatever. But he gave no verbal reason for them to believe that he would. And I think it's quite clear, given the makeup of his cabinet, his actual policies, he'd be more than happy to sign a repeal of Davis-Bacon.
Yes.
And that's that moment of reckoning, because that will devastate these unions. And the thing about it is when that happens, and it's very bad for American workers if Davis-Bacon gets repealed. But because of the actions of these building trade union leaders, nobody on the left is going to care. They have not built any of the solidarity or any of the alliances that other unions have. So, for instance, you know, SEIU's Fight for 15 has gone viral within the left. UFCW's work with Walmart workers, these sorts of things build alliances between unions and other parts of the left.
Yes.
The building trades haven't done that, and so nobody's going to care when Davis-Bacon gets repealed, and they're going to have no allies to help them have this fight.
So another group of Trump supporters that are headed for some serious buyer's remorse, whether they know it or not at this point. I would just stress that we're talking about the building trade unions and that many other unions play a really integral role in the resistance to Trump and in the larger progressive movement. So let's just make sure that we distinguish between the various sectors that we're talking about. Eric Loomis, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this week.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
I ain't a killer, but don't push me. Birth the universe, it's the power of the pussy. And even if they had $1 billion, I would never give the pussy. pussy up to a misogynistic rapper. It was probably ugly as a kid, hella chubby. Only girl he ever took to prom was his cousin. Now they acting bitter and they writing in a song like they've been waking up with two women all along. I'm the next supreme, I'm the next supreme. Word to the queen by any mean, murder scene. Pussy kill, I'm a savage with a slit. A cuntess with a killer ammunition in the. Cause pussy only power when you hold a tight grip. Never give the pussy up till they bow and worship. He gon' want the pussy now, but he don't deserve it. Till he put himself to work and he willing to commit, to commit. Here, pussy, pussy. Kill, pussy, pussy. Here, pussy, pussy. Kill, pussy, pussy. Here, pussy, pussy. Kill, pussy, pussy. Here, pussy, pussy. Yeah. My pussy so nice, my pussy so strong. It sounds so good when I put it in the song. Rappers always wanna put my pussy in the rhyme. Politicians pass law with my pussy on their mind. They can never handle what it takes to give birth. Say my pussy's weak, try to claim it as a turf.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Cas Muda. He's an associate professor at the University of Georgia's School of Public and International Affairs. Professor Muda, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. We had Tom Papinski from Cornell on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that Americans have this common perception that life under modern authoritarian governments is a kind of a dystopian nightmare. We tend to think of authoritarianism as, you know, secret police taking people away in the middle of the night, not permitting any dissent, any criticism. He argued that this view is somewhat dangerous because it might make people less sensitive to kind of softer forms of authoritarian government. Modern authoritarian governments, he argues, they like a little bit of dissent. They like to have elections as long as they have control of the outcomes. Is that a view that you share? Do we tend to think of democracy and authoritarianism in binary terms, or maybe we should see them as kind of two points on a continuum?
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think that we have this idea that democracy exists in this perfect form, that obviously it doesn't, and then that the alternative almost is like a fascism, where everything is controlled by the state and there's absolutely no space for any type of dissent or different opinion. But these type of regimes really don't exist anymore. And today, almost every country has elections, and every country argues to be democratic. And everyone knows that open repression is highly problematic. And so much of the repression, as actually under, for example, communism, doesn't work necessarily through violence. It works through self-censorship. What they try to do is just create an atmosphere in which people start to censor themselves.
You're one of a number of experts on authoritarianism and right-wing movements who's expressed alarm at Donald Trump's early moves. We're only 3 weeks into this presidency, which is kind of hard to believe almost, given how much chaos there's been. What has set off alarm bells for you so far?
Well, the most worrying thing is this combination of unpreparedness and emotional responses. I mean, it's absolutely clear that anyone who has argued that Donald Trump was kind of in character while he was campaigning and would transform into a much more measured politician was completely wrong. Donald Trump, the president, is exactly the same person as Donald Trump, the candidate. And among other things, that is a deeply authoritarian personality and a highly erratic politician. And those things are always problematic. But if you combine that with the most powerful army in the world, it is really worrying.
And how significant do you find Trump's ongoing war with the press? Is it typical for authoritarian regimes to create kind of their own reality and then lash out at those who question it?
Yeah, that is, I think that's very normal. And to be fair, there are a lot of politicians who have a problem with a critical press, and only part of those are authoritarian or illiberal Democrats. To be honest, I find that part not even the most worrying. I understand that the press finds it the most interesting. But so far, he hasn't done that much, and actually he has only pretty much spiked subscriptions to the New York Times and Washington Post.
Right.
I think the effect that's what's much more worrying is how he speaks about the courts and how he responds to, like, he gets his information from Fox News and even from Alex Jones. He doesn't get it from, like, all the agencies that he has at his disposal. He responds directly and almost always in an authoritarian way, like, about Chicago, we'll send in the feds. About Berkeley, I will take federal funding away. Like, that's not how Democrats work.
Right. And there have been a number of reports about Trump's team battling the federal bureaucracy. The career government employees across a number of agencies. This has been both in terms of asking them to provide the names of, for example, the EPA, people who've been working on climate change, ordering them to stop communicating, various agencies to stop communicating with the public. Is that a warning signal as well? Is that something typical of authoritarian regimes?
Yeah. And again, he will probably not be able to actually fire those people or ban them from all kind of things. Most people are going to censor themselves, right? Because, look, you can take on someone who runs for office, but taking on the president of the United States is a very different issue. And even though you feel that you have the Constitution on your side, are you going to take that risk? And so the biggest problem of contemporary illiberal democracies like Turkey or Russia or Hungary is that we actually don't see the extent of the censorship, because so much of it is self-censorship.
So let me turn that around. When we talk about the potential for sliding into authoritarianism, you're talking about self-censorship. It seems to me that it's contingent on the way that the rest of the government responds, as well as how civil society responds. And I can see what has happened in the first few weeks in a couple of different ways. We could be heartened by the leaks. This administration is leaking like a sieve. Various reports of government workers resisting these rogue Twitter accounts coming out of a number of agencies. So you could say, well, people are not accepting this blithely. They're not so far self-censoring. Of course, the courts are standing up to Trump so far. On the other hand, the most prominent check on the executive has always been the legislature, which has largely rolled over for this president. Do you see this glass half full or half empty? Your thoughts?
I don't even know where it is, half full or half empty. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical about all the leaks and, like, now the town halls where Republicans are being shouted down. I mean, after all, these are things that liberals were very upset about when the Tea Party did it. These are kind of last-ditch attempts of a struggling democracy. I rather see positive actions. And the thing is that we have to keep in mind that Trump is still an outsider within the GOP, and so his control of the political system is dependent upon what the GOP does, and the GOP is an independent actor here. I don't see any resistance, and my reading of it is that the GOP is not going to stand up to Trump in any significant way until it gets its agenda through, which is mostly deregulation and some other stuff. After that, they will probably start to stand up to him, but how much damage can be done by that time?
Yeah, we do live in worry sometimes. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, which, by the way, I think those are among the four scariest words I've ever uttered. moments after being confirmed, Jeff Sessions claimed that we're seeing a dangerous, quote, dangerous permanent trend in rising violent crime. Donald Trump has said the violent crime rate is the highest it's been in 47 years. the regime has cited a number of terror attacks that never happened. And the reality is that the rate of violent crime has been in steady decline for, I don't know, almost 30 years. It's now half of what it was in 1991. Is this tendency to claim more crime and chaos than really exists consistent with authoritarian governments?
Yeah, with all authoritarians, right? I mean, we know that when people are afraid, they are willing to accept much more infringements up in their privacy and up in their rights. I mean, just look how the Patriot Act was pushed through within only a couple of days. And so if you can create this mood where people are afraid, they will not focus on, in a sense, the harm done to liberal democracy, because at that point in time, security overrides everything. And I do think that this is extremely worrying. On the other hand, what we see from polls is that, by and large, Trump is speaking to a relatively small core, radical right core of about 20-25% of the people who buy into his policies. The thing is that this is a sizable portion of the GOP electorate, right? And again, in the short run, the power is still within the GOP, and it is up to liberals and centrists to explain to the GOP that their long-term interest is in standing up for liberal democratic values, and that is where the vast majority of Americans are.
Yeah, it's really important to note, and I think listeners need to understand that Donald Trump has the lowest approval rating of any newly elected president in the history of polling, but, and this is really key, but he has retained support of 85-90% of self-identified Republicans. And exactly. when you're a legislator, you don't care about his national favorability ratings. What you care about is how popular he is back at home. So when we look at Congress and its seeming inability or unwillingness to stand up to Trump, it's important to understand that these lawmakers are looking at their constituents, and they see a president that is still popular among their constituents if they're in, you know, so-called red districts. Professor, before I let you go, I want to get a sense of what you'll be watching as we move forward. Again, we're only 3 weeks into this. So far, a lot of Trump's norm violations have been alarming, but somewhat inconsequential. And I'm not talking about executive orders, but his like Twitter attacks on judges have been Twitter attacks. He hasn't tried to, you know, shut down the judiciary. What kind of moves would really set off our alarm bells, should really set off our alarm bells moving forward, based on your experience?
So I think that the key point is electoral rules, districts, although gerrymandering is so extreme that you can hardly make that worse, and disenfranchisement campaigns. And so I'm totally convinced that if Americans vote according to the same rules and with the same electorate, they will make Trump a one-term president. But at all levels, people are being appointed, like Jeff Sessions and the SCOTUS nominee, who have a track record of pushing for or allowing disenfranchisement. And that is really where you see a move in the last couple of years among the GOP. So Trump is not alone there. He will get that through Congress. And if even more people are being excluded, which of course are disproportionately potential Democrat voters, they might actually just create a majority next time. And that kind of electoral engineering to stay in power is very typical of the liberal Democrats.
Right. It's not the voters choosing the politician. It's the politicians choosing their voters.
Exactly.
And I would point out just to listeners that it was reported this week that 20 different red states, lawmakers in 20 different red states are proposing new restrictions on voting based on Donald Trump's claim that 3 million people voted illegally in the 2016 election. Cass Muda, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
You're welcome.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back with Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm pleased to welcome Ryan Devereaux, who is a reporter for The Intercept. Ryan has a piece titled Trump Administration Prepares to Execute Vicious Executive Order on Deportations. Listeners can Google up that piece, and I suggest that they do. It's really alarming. Ryan, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, okay, Trump signed two executive orders on immigration on January 25th. As you note in your piece, much of what they contain was kind of lost in the reporting of his call to build a wall. The wall got all the attention. Then this so-called Muslim ban came down. So these two orders have not gotten as much attention as I think they should. I appreciate your piece. Can you tell us about what these orders would do?
Yeah, so the two orders, they're very closely related. One is focused on border security, and one is focused on public safety in the interior of the United States. And combined, they sort of lay the foundations for the sort of mass deportation apparatus that Trump has indicated he's interested in setting up. So in the case of the border order, we're looking at asylum officers and judges being directed to detention centers, immigrant detention centers around the country to sort of facilitate the increased use of expedited removal, which is a process for what it sounds like removing people from the country. We're looking at creation of more detention facilities, immigrant detention facilities along the U.S. border, including through private contracts, so private prisons continuing to be deeply involved in the detention of immigrants. And then in the second order, some of the real shocking elements of that order include a real broadening of the universe of individuals who are prioritized for enforcement under the Trump administration. And this includes, you know, people who may have been charged with a crime decades ago and had that case run its course, or it could be people who were not charged with a crime, but, believed to have done something that constituted a criminal offense in the eyes of the authorities. And it really takes the range of people who are in the crosshairs and radically expands it, which really calls into question Trump's repeated claims that his interest is solely, violent criminals. There are a lot of people who will be impacted by these orders if they're brought to fruition.
Now, Trump, as you said, says he wants to prioritize so-called criminal aliens, which, as you note, can be defined very broadly or narrowly. Once he gets the resources to triple the number of ICE agents doing interior enforcement, which he has called for, if he gets those resources, and one presumes that with a Republican Congress, he will, those people need to do something, and that means workplace raids, families being ripped apart, etc. Do we have a sense of how many people might be eligible for removal if the regime gets its way?
Well, the LA Times did an analysis of that question a week or so ago, and they put the number at around 8 million, which is huge. We don't know. I don't know if there's a number that the administration is shooting for, but the scale of people who are targetable and prioritized is really vast. And one of the things I should mention, and it's also included in these domestic enforcement orders that the administration has signed, is sort of deputization of state and local law enforcement to be involved in basically immigration enforcement across the country. And this is something that's been tried before with disastrous results, something that a lot of police executives, police chiefs really push back against because they don't feel that this is their lane and they feel it's a waste of limited resources and they feel that it creates fear and hostility in immigrant communities, which it does, and these programs have been repeatedly linked to racial profiling. But that is something that the administration is pushing for as well. And in order to get cities to comply, police departments to comply with that vision, they're threatening, you know, to cut off federal grants and funding for cities. And the amount of money that is sort of at stake here is in the billions, according to Reuters. And it includes money that would be set aside for things like public housing, for Head Start programs, for HIV/AIDS research. I mean, they're really threatening to do damage to vulnerable populations in cities if the police departments don't fall in line, which is extremely troubling.
So just to recap, there was the Secure Communities program. It was highly controversial, as you say. And what they're doing is they're threatening to withhold federal funding from so-called sanctuary cities. I should note that my little town, which is about 90 miles north of New York City, recently declared itself a sanctuary city after a series of very contentious hearings. I'm kind of proud of dinky little Kingston, New York right now. You talked about the potential for increasing detention centers along the border. There are asylum seekers. Tell us a little bit about the background here as far as the changes that have already been made under the Obama administration in terms of asylees coming into the country. A lot of people have this idea of illegal immigrants sneaking over the border, but the reality is that the net migration of immigrants has dropped to zero. But we've had a surge of asylum seekers who come across the border and seek out a Border Patrol agent, turn themselves over, and say, "I will be killed if I return home."
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. It's this sort of little noticed element of the Obama administration's legacy on immigration. In 2014, many people will remember a lot of, you know, stories circulating about this flood of a lot of unaccompanied children from Central America showing up on the southern border. And you know, people should recognize that what a lot of these kids and these families were fleeing were some of the most violent, deadly cities with the highest homicide rates on the planet, where institutions were utterly failing, showing up at the U.S. border and asking to be taken in. And just like you said, often you had kids and families showing up basically turning themselves over and saying, "I'm here to apply for asylum." The Obama administration, DHS, under Jay Johnson's response to that was one of deterrence. So basically start housing these folks and turning them around as quickly as they can. So ramping up the use of expedited removal and building a couple of very, very controversial large facilities in Texas, for-profit-run detention facilities where women and their children were housed, jailed, as they went through these proceedings. There's a third facility that's not privately run, that's smaller, that's in Pennsylvania, that was also part of this family detention apparatus. And so these places would be full of women and kids who were coming to the country seeking asylum, who the administration determined needed to be removed from the country as quickly as possible. So that sort of architecture, that sort of framework for housing lots of families already existed before Trump came in, and it has been a huge problem, a huge underreported problem for immigration attorneys and people who work on these issues. So the asylum situation is really real, and people do come here, and asylum is a thing that the U.S. government recognizes. I mean, it's part of who we are to take people in, but in the last years of the Obama administration, asylum became something that the response to asylum was one of deterrence. And, there was a lot of cold, harsh policies that were enacted by the Obama administration that I'm afraid we could see really turned up several notches now that Trump is in power.
Yeah, these were already really, really just tragic policies that I fear are going to get turned up to 11. It's important to note that the status quo ante was that they would be released in pending a hearing. Those hearings could take quite a while, so they would basically be released legally. They would be released and have legal residence until their case was heard by a judge or other officiating officer. And I just want to backtrack 1 second on the sanctuary cities question and note that, you know, Trump is big on law and order. Sanctuary cities sounds like a mushy liberal thing, but the reality is that when immigrant communities fear deportation, if they come into contact with police, what happens is that they don't report crimes. They don't speak up if they witness crimes. They don't cooperate with law enforcement, and it makes policing these communities much more difficult. It's antithetical to law and order. Ryan, before I let you go, this has been, Donald Trump is building off of a narrative that is especially coming from the right for as long as I have been writing about immigration, which is that the southern border that there's chaos along the southern border and that the government somehow refuses to enforce its immigration laws. The reality, of course, is that the federal government prosecutes more people for violating immigration laws than all other offenses combined. Have you ever visited the southern border?
I have. Yeah, I was actually down there for a separate story earlier this year, and it's really striking how militarized the whole area is. And the notion that the border has not been prioritized is just simply false. The buildup of surveillance technology there, the militarization of the entire area, the buildup of the border patrol, all of that, it's been well documented. It's just ignored in the realms of politics because that's the way things are in this country. But yeah, you're absolutely correct.
I mean, I put it up there with the, you know, claiming that 3 million illegal voters, it's just, or that climate change is a Chinese hoax. It's just, it's 100% opposite from the facts on the ground if anybody travels down there. And I would point out one other thing. You know, the border communities, these are very old transnational communities. For hundreds of years, you have families who have crossed back and forth more or less freely to see each other, to work, to go to school. And the rapid increase in border security has caused lax training, and there have been abundant problems. When you talk to people in these communities, they see Border Patrol as almost an occupying force, and the abuses, large and small, of people in these communities, including, I have to say, American citizens, is just outrageous, and it's happening all of the time.
That's absolutely correct, and I just want to add that in calling for a massive increase in the number of immigration agents and enforcement agents that Trump is looking for, we should be very wary of standards being lowered so that more agents can be brought in. We saw what happened when this was done with the Border Patrol, which was a huge increase in abuses by agents. And I fear that we could see that sort of pattern repeat itself if we see another surge in recruitment that could be accompanied with the lowering of standards. And it's a really dangerous thing whenever you have a paramilitary organization, a police department, whatever it is, trying to bolster its numbers rapidly. Problems almost inevitably always follow.
And on that happy note, Ryan Devereaux, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank Eric Loomis and Chas Muda. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. Send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. And I would also like to thank the folks at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and the Smirking Trump for letting us host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.